From the American College of Cardiology, this is Dr. Kim Eagle, ACC.org, Editor-in-Chief, with this week's Eagle's Eye View, your weekly cardiovascular update from ACC.org. In this week's view, I want to talk about three articles that were published this past week that I think are interesting. The first deal with the treatment of hypertension, and the third article we'll talk about is the emergence of transcatheter mitral valve replacement in patients with various mitral valve issues. The first article was entitled "The Benefits and Harms of Antihypertensive Treatment in Low-Risk Patients with Mild Hypertension." As you probably know, the European guidelines on the treatment of hypertension really choose a slightly different strategy than the American guidelines, and particularly surrounding patients in kind of that mild range of hypertension, the greater than 130 but less than 140 systolic range, for example. So this was a really interesting cohort study. It was a look at the data involving electronic medical records across all of England and data from 1998 till 2015 for adults age 18 to 74 who had mild hypertension defined as an untreated blood pressure of 140 over 90 to 159 over 99 in the clinic and no previous treatment. They excluded patients with cardiovascular disease or cardiovascular disease risk factors from the analysis. So this would be a group of patients who would be considered low risk. And then they examined the medical records for primary exposure to antihypertensive medicines. And they were looking for outcomes such as death and cardiovascular events and adverse events as well, particularly among those prescribed antihypertensives. So it was a large study, almost 20,000 patients, the mean age about 55. 56 were women, and about 55% were Caucasian. And they were matched to roughly 19,000 similar untreated patients. Again, mean age 55, 55% female, 55% Caucasian. And then they looked at the records over a period of almost 6 years. And the first thing they looked at was whether or not there was association of antihypertensive treatment and mortality, and there was no relationship. And they looked at whether or not there was a relationship between hypertensive treatment and cardiovascular disease outcomes, and there was no effect either. They did notice that patients who got antihypertensives had a higher risk of adverse events, including hypotension, which happened if you treated 41 patients, that was one episode. Syncope, the number needed to harm, was 35. And electrolyte abnormalities, the number needed to harm, was 111. And acute injury, the number needed to harm, was 91. So the authors concluded that this pre-specified matched analysis in a cohort study in England did not find evidence that pushing antihypertensive therapy in low-risk patients in the mild range of hypertension had any benefit. Obviously, this is observational. It's impossible using medical records information to control for various types of comorbidities. But it is an interesting paper that I thought does shed some light on the current management of hypertension. It's interesting if you think about the U.S. guidelines really have a fairly significant reliance on the SPRINT trial. And you may recall from SPRINT that patients with hypertension, if they were able to get their systolic blood pressures, say, from 144 down to or below 130, there was benefit. But it was an interesting aspect of SPRINT that it really was a treatment target study. Most of those patients in SPRINT were already on antihypertensives. And so that lead-in period may have screened out individuals who are going to have unusual side effects from antihypertensives like syncope, electrolyte imbalances, hypotension. And so the European guidelines currently are a little more relaxed than the American guidelines, and I think it's in part due to this difference between what's the threshold to treat versus the target. And SPRINT was really a target type of study. So the second study is also related to hypertension, and I liked it a lot. It's called the Early Cardiovascular Protection by Initial Two-Drug Fixed-Dose Combination Treatment versus Monotherapy in Hypertension. And this study was taken from a database in Italy, the Lombardy region of Italy, which has 44,000 residents. and they looked at individuals from 2010 on who were started either on one antihypertensive drug, 37,000, or who were started on a two-drug fixed-dose combination, almost 7,500, and they were followed for a year. And they were looking for evidence of hospitalization or other types of events in the two cohorts. In order to avoid confounding, they did a matching analysis using high-dimensional propensity scoring to try to adjust for various changes that might have occurred, differences in comorbidity. Interestingly, they found that the fixed-dose combination had a reduction in the one-year risk of hospitalization for any cardiovascular event, a reduction of about 21% relative risk. And even when they did matching and propensity adjustment, there was about a 15% reduction. So this was, I think, very interesting. The risk of hospitalization was less in patients with ischemic heart disease, atrial fibrillation, cerebral vascular disease, and heart failure. They concluded that antihypertensive monotherapy performed less well than using a fixed-dose combination strategy for cardiovascular protection in patients being initially treated for hypertension. It's interesting, both the U.S. and the European guidelines talk about this. And in general, I think the studies are pretty clear that using lower doses of multiple agents is going to be more effective than trying to push high doses of a single agent for hypertension. Both the effectiveness and the safety appear to favor the use of fixed-dose combinations. And certainly this study would be supportive of that. And this is something that I try to strive for in my own practice as well. The third article was published this week in the European Heart Journal. It's entitled The Outcomes of Transcatheter Mitral Valve Replacement for Degenerated Bioprostheses, Failed Annuloplasty Rings, and Mitral Annular Calcification. And it was a study from a multi-center registry looking at 40 European and American centers reviewing the procedural and clinical outcome of doing a transcatheter mitral valve replacement for patients with either a degenerated bioprosthesis, a failed annuloplasty ring, or a severe mitral annular calcification. So 521 patients were studied. They had an STS score of 9%, which meant high risk for conventional mitral valve surgery. Roughly 322 were patients who had valve-in-valve, 141 valve in ring, and 58 valve in mitral annular calcification. As expected, their age was up there at 73 years, 54% were female, and 90% were either class 3 or class 4 heart failure in terms of their symptoms. Transseptal access was used about 40% of the time, and Sapien valves were the valve of choice in about 90%. The technical success rate was 87%. And over a median of about a half a year, a total of 117 patients died in the overall cohort. So the one-year all-cause and cardiovascular mortality rates were 23.5% and 20% respectively. LV outflow tract obstruction occurred more in the procedures in the valve in mitral annular calcification group than the valve in ring or valve in valve, about 40% versus less than 5%. A second valve implantation was more frequent, of course, in valve in ring compared to the other two cohorts, happening at about 12%. The technical success rate was higher for the valve-in-valve procedure, 94.4% versus 81% in the valve-in-ring and only 62% in the valve-in-mitral annular calcification group. Also, as you might expect, the valve-in-ring group had a higher rate of mitral regurgitation, being at least moderate. That was almost 20%. And perivalvular leak also was higher, about 8%. All-cause mortality was significantly higher when this procedure was done in the valve in mitral annular calcification group at 34%. And on multivariate analysis in the total cohort, doing this in a failed annuloplasty ring or with severe mitral annular calcification was associated with higher mortality. So I think it's an important paper. It's a pretty large number of patients having transcatheter mitral valve replacement. certainly suggests that when we're doing valve-in-valve therapies with this strategy that we are on pretty safe ground, less so for the valve and ring. And doing this in a heavily calcified mitral valve clearly had significant problems, and particularly both failure and early mortality. Obviously, the whole field of structural therapies for valve disease is in a renaissance, and I'm sure we'll see continuous progress in the years ahead with the percutaneous approach to the mitral valve, as we've seen with the aortic valve. So I want to thank you for listening to Eagle's Eye View. This is your weekly cardiovascular update from ACC.org. You can find this on the American College of Cardiology's website. Also look for a new educational catalog feature on ACC.org. It's located under the Education and Meetings tab. Using that tool, you can sort our educational offerings by various formats, many of which are free. Find us online or wherever you get your podcasts. And until next week, I hope you have a great one. Thank you.